This is lecture 6 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Human Values in Education, entitled Parent-Teacher Meetings, given July 22, 1924. Before going any further with our discussion of methods, I would like to add something to what I said yesterday about teachers' conferences. We attach great importance to our relationship with the parents of children at our Waldorf school, and to ensure complete harmony, we schedule frequent parents' evenings, attended by the parents of children living in the neighborhood. At these meetings, we discuss the intentions, methods, and arrangements of the school, in a somewhat general way, of course. And to the degree that such gatherings allow, the parents are able to express their wishes and receive a sympathetic hearing. Thus, we have an opportunity to determine our educational goals, and moreover, do this within the social context from which those goals originated. The teachers listen to the parents' ideas about their children's education, and the parents hear, we always speak to them in a sincere and candid way, about events in the school, our thoughts on the children's education and future, and why we need schools that advance a free approach to education. In other words, this leads to a mutual understanding between the teachers and parents that arises because we maintain human contact that is not just abstract and intellectual. We feel this kind of connection is very important, because this is all that we can rely upon. In a state school, everything is strictly regulated. We know exactly the goals that teachers must bear in mind. We know, for example, that a child of 9 must reach a certain standard, and so on. Everything is planned with precision. In our case, everything depends on the free individuality of each teacher. Insofar as I am considered the school's director, nothing is given in the form of rules and regulations. In fact, there is no school director in the usual sense. Each teacher is sovereign. Instead of a school director or administrator, we have teachers' conferences, where the teachers study and work in common toward progress. Consequently, there is a concrete spirit that lives and works freely in the College of Teachers. It is not tyrannical, nor does it issue statements, rules, or programs. Rather, it exerts its will to continually advance and improve the teacher's ability to meet the needs of teaching. Today, our teachers have no idea what will be good for the Waldorf School 5 years later, because during those years they will learn much, and from that knowledge they will have to reassess what is or is not correct. This is why Waldorf schools are indifferent toward associations for school reform and what they consider important. Educational matters cannot be determined intellectually. They should arise only from the experience of teaching. The College of Teachers works through experience, but just because this is the situation, because we live in a state of flux in terms of what we want, we need a different kind of support system than that of ordinary schools, which is given by educational authorities who dictate what schools do. We require the support of the social context in which the children are growing up. We need the inner support of the parents, because questions always come up when children come to school, and they come from the homes of their parents. If the goal is to create individual and harmonious relationships, teachers may be even more concerned with the welfare of the children than the parents themselves, from whom they seek support. When receiving a child of 7 into school, our teachers take on much more than expected if they go beyond merely taking in the parents' information, which provides little, but show further interest by visiting the parents at home. Teachers have the fathers, the mothers, and others in the children's lives. They are like shadows in the child's background. Teachers are almost as involved with those people as they are with the children themselves, especially when it comes to physical pathologies. Teachers must take this all into account and work it out for themselves. They must look at the whole situation to truly understand the children, and above all, they must be clear about what they need to do in relation to a child's environment. By visiting the parents at home, the teachers build a bridge between themselves and the parents, and this becomes a support that is social and at the same time free and alive. Home visits are necessary if we want to nurture a feeling in the parents that nothing should undermine the natural sense for authority that children should feel toward their teachers. The College of Teachers and the parents must work hard together to reach an understanding that is imbued with feeling, soul qualities. Moreover, parents must get to know the teachers thoroughly and break any tendency to be jealous of them, because most parents are in fact jealous of their children's teachers. They feel as if the teachers want to take the children away from them. But as soon as this feeling arises, nothing can be accomplished with the children educationally. These things can be corrected, however, if teachers understand how to gain real support from the parents. This is what I wanted to add to my previous remarks on the purpose of teachers' conferences. Now we must consider something else. We must begin to understand the times in the lives of children that are important points of transition. I spoke of one such point already, when imaginative and pictorial teaching must move on and teach children about the nature of the plants. This point comes around the age of 9 or 10. It manifests in children as an inner restlessness, and they begin to ask all sorts of questions. The questions are not usually all that important in terms of their subject matter, but it is very important to note that the children have begun to feel a need to ask questions. The relationship we establish with children at this time has great importance for their whole life. What is living in the souls of these children? We can observe it in every child who is not suffering a pathology. Before this age, any child who has not been harmed by outer influences will naturally accept the authority of the teacher. Healthy children who have not been convinced of all kinds of nonsense will have a healthy respect for every adult. They look up to adults and accept them naturally as authorities. Recall your own childhood and think about what it means, especially for young children, to feel good about doing what an adult does because that person is good and worthy. Children need nothing more than to place themselves under an authority. In a sense, this feeling is shaken somewhat between 9 and 10 through the development of human nature itself. It is important to have the capacity to perceive this clearly. It is a time when human nature experiences something special. It does not become conscious in children, but lives in vague sensations and feelings. Children cannot express this, but it is present nonetheless. And what do these children think unconsciously? Earlier, they might have said instinctively, if my teacher says something is good, it must be good. If my teacher says something is bad, it is bad. If my teacher says something is correct, then it must be correct. If my teacher says it is wrong, it has to be wrong. If my teacher is pleased by something, then it is beautiful. If my teacher says something is ugly and unpleasant, then it is ugly. It is quite natural for young children to see their teachers as models, but between 9 and 10 their inner certainty is shaken somewhat. In their feeling life, children begin to inquire about the source of the teacher's authority. Who is the authority over the teacher, and what is the source of that authority? At this point, children begin to sense an inner urge to penetrate the visible human being who has been a god to them, and discover what stands behind the person as a suprasensory, invisible god or divine being. Now teachers must face the children, and in a simple way try to confirm this feeling in them. They must approach the children so that they sense something suprasensory that supports their teacher. Teachers must not speak in an arbitrary way, because they are messengers of the divine. You must make children aware of this, but certainly not by preaching. You can only hint through words. Nothing is accomplished by a pedantic approach. But you can achieve something by approaching the children and saying something of no particular importance. You might say a few words that are unimportant, but spoken in a tone of voice that suggests you have a heart, and this heart believes in what stands behind it. You must make the children aware that you are standing within the universe, but this must be done in the right way. Even if they are still unable to absorb abstract, rational ideas, they do have enough understanding to come and ask you how they too can know. Children of this age often come with such questions. Now you might say, just think, all that I am able to give you, I receive from the sun, S-U-N. If the sun did not exist, I would be unable to give you anything at all. And while we sleep, if the divine power of the moon were not there to preserve all that we receive from the sun, I would be unable to give you anything. In terms of meaning, you have not said anything particularly important, but if you say it with such warmth that the children feel their love for the sun and moon, then you can lead them beyond the stage of asking such questions, and in general, this holds for all of life. You must realize that these critical points occur in children's lives. A new feeling arises naturally. Until now you told stories about a fir and an oak, about a buttercup and a dandelion, or about a sunflower and a violet. You spoke about nature and fairy tales, and thus you led the children into a world of spirit. Now it is time to tell stories from the Gospels. If you begin this earlier or try to teach them anything religious, it destroys something in children. But if you begin this when you are trying to break through to the spirit world, you can accomplish something that children demand with their whole being. Where can you find a book that tells teachers what teaching really is? It is the children themselves who form that book. We should not learn teaching methods from any book except the one that opens before us as the children themselves. In order to read in this book, however, we need the broadest possible interest in such individual, in each individual child. And nothing must divert us from this. This is where teachers are likely to experience difficulties, and these must be overcome consciously. Imagine a teacher who has children of her own. She is faced with a more direct and difficult task than if she had no children. She must be even more aware, and above all, not believe, not even subconsciously, that all children should be like hers. She must ask herself whether all people who have children subconsciously believe that every child should be like theirs. We can see that teachers must acknowledge something that touches the most intimate threads of one's soul life. And unless you can go into these intimate subconscious threads, you will never gain real access to children and win their full confidence. Children suffer untold damage by believing that other children are the teacher's favorites. This must be avoided at all costs. It is not as easy to avoid as one might think, but it can be avoided by teachers who are imbued with the principles that arise from a spiritual scientific knowledge of the human being. Then such questions discover their own solutions. There is something that requires special attention in relation to the theme I chose for this lecture course. It is connected with the importance of education for the whole world and for humankind itself. It is the very nature of human existence that teachers who are so involved with children and generally have so little time to live outside of those activities require support from the outer world and must look out into the larger world. Why do teachers dry up so easily? It is because they must always bend to the level of the children. We certainly have no reason to make fun of teachers who, because they are limited to the usual concept of teaching, become dried up. Nevertheless, we should see where the danger lies, and anthroposophic teachers are in a position to be especially aware of this. If the ordinary teacher's notion of history gradually becomes like a textbook, which can happen in just a few years, where should they look for other ideas that are truly human? What is the remedy? What little time teachers are left with after a school week is usually spent recovering from fatigue, and frequently it is merely popular politics that form their attitudes about matters of world importance. Consequently, the soul life of such teachers is not turned outward with the kind of understanding needed by people between, say, 30 and 40. Furthermore, they do not keep fit and well by thinking that the best way to recuperate during leisure hours is to play cards or do something else that has no connection with the spiritual life. The situation for teachers, whose life is permeated with spiritual science, is very different. Their perspective on the world continually broadens. Their vision continues to extend further. It is easy to show how such things affect each other. It manifests in the most enthusiastic anthroposophists, for example, one who becomes a history teacher and tends to carry spiritual scientific views into history lessons, thus making the mistake of teaching anthroposophy instead of history. This must also be avoided. This problem can be completely avoided by teachers who, with the children on the one hand and anthroposophy on the other, feel the need to build a bridge between the school and the homes of parents. Although spiritual science is knowledge and understanding applied to the human being, there are nevertheless necessities in life that must be observed. What is the common thinking today, influenced as people are by current ideas about educational reform or by revolutionary ideas in this area? I will not go into what socialists have to say, but will limit myself to the thinking of the upper middle classes. They seem to think that people should get out of the city and move to the country so that children can be properly educated away from town. It is felt that this is the only way children can develop in a natural way, and so it goes. But how does such thinking fit with more comprehensive views of the world, with a more comprehensive view of the world? It is really an admission of personal helplessness. The important point is not to invent some way to educate a number of children apart from the world and according to one's own intellectual abstract ideas. Rather, the point is to discover how we can help children grow into real human beings in society, which is indeed their environment. We must gather our strength and not remove children from the society in which they live. It is essential to have such courage. This is connected with the significance of education in the world. There must also be a deep sense that the world should find its way into the school. The world must always exist within the school, though in a childlike way. So if we stand for healthy education, we should not invent all kinds of activities intended only for children. All sorts of things are devised for children to do. For example, they must learn to braid. They must perform all kinds of meaningless activities that are completely unrelated to life, just to keep the children busy. Such methods never serve any real purpose in the children's development. Rather, all play at school should imitate life. Everything must come from life, with nothing invented. So, despite the good intentions behind them, things such as those introduced by Froebel are, or others, to educate little children are really unrelated to child development. Footnote: Friedrich Wilhelm August Froebel, I don't know if I say that Froebel, however you say that, F-R-O-U-M-L-A, 1782-1852, educator and advocate for kindergarten, devised play methods for the early education. End of footnote. These are inventions that belong to our age of rationalism, and theory should not form the basis of a school's activities. Above all, there must be a hidden sense that life rules everything in education. In this sense, our experiences can be quite remarkable. I told you that when children reach the age of changing teeth, their education should be smoothed through painting or drawing. Writing, a form of drawing that has become abstract, should be developed through painted drawings or drawn paintings. It should be kept in mind, however, that children are very sensitive to aesthetic impressions. There are little artists hiding in them, and some very interesting discoveries can be made. A truly good teacher may be placed in charge of a class, one who is ready to do what I have described, one who is filled with enthusiasm and ready to do away with earlier methods of education and to educate in this new way. Such teachers begin with this method of painted drawings or drawn paintings. The jars of paint and the paintbrushes are prepared, and the children pick up their brushes. Now you may experience something like this. You have no idea of the difference between a color that shines and one that does not. You are too old. In this way, you can have an odd experience. I once had the opportunity of telling an excellent chemist about our efforts to produce radiant, shining colors for the paintings in the Gertianum, and how we were experimenting with colors made from plants. Footnote: the Gertianum, designed by Rudolf Steiner, is the headquarters for the Anthroposophical Society in Dornach, Switzerland. End of footnote. He replied, quote, "But we can already do much better than that. Today we have the means to produce colors that are iridescent and begin to shimmer when it is dark." Unquote. That chemist did not understand anything I was saying. He immediately thought in terms of chemistry. Adults often lack any sense of shining color. Children still have this sense. If you can read in the nature of childhood what they still possess, everything goes along wonderfully with very few words. The guidance of teachers must arise through an approach that is understanding and artistic. In this way, children easily find their way into everything their teachers wish to bring them. None of this can be brought about unless we can feel deeply that our school is a place for young life. At the same time, we must recognize what is appropriate for adult life. We must cultivate a sensitivity as to what can and cannot be done. Now, please, do not be offended by what I am about to say. Last year, in the context of a conference on anthroposophic education, the following incident occurred. There was the desire to show a public audience eurythmy, which plays such an important role in our education. This was done, but by children who gave a demonstration of what they had learned at school in eurythmy lessons. A performance, showing eurythmy as an art, was given later on. The arrangements did not allow people the opportunity to gain some understanding of eurythmy as introduced to the school. It was done the other way round. The children's eurythmy demonstration was given first. As a result, the audience was unconvinced and had no idea what it was all about. Just imagine that until now there had been no art of painting, and suddenly an exhibition is held that shows children's first attempts with colors. Those outside the anthroposophic movement could not see in that children's demonstration the true intentions behind anthroposophy and eurythmy. Such a demonstration has no meaning unless eurythmy is introduced first as an art. Then people can see its role in life and its significance in the world of art. And the importance of eurythmy in education can also be recognized. Otherwise, people may see arrhythmia as just another of the many whimsical ideas in the world. These things must lead us not only to prepare ourselves to work in education in the old narrow sense, but to work with a somewhat broader view, so that school is not separated from life, but an integral part of it. This is just as important as inventing some clever method in education. I have repeatedly stressed the fact that it is the mental attitude that counts, a mental attitude and a gift of insight. Obviously, not everything is equally perfect. This goes without saying. I ask you not to misunderstand what was just said, and this applies to anthroposophists as well. I appreciate everything that is done, as it is here, with such willing sacrifice. However, if I had not spoken in this way, something like the following could occur. Wherever there is strong light, there are strong shadows. So wherever efforts are made toward the more spiritual accomplishments, there the darkest shadows also arise. The danger is not less than in conventional groups, but greater. And if we wish to be up to the tasks that confront us in a life that is becoming increasingly complex, we must be especially awake and aware of what life requires of humankind. We no longer have those sharply defined traditions that guided earlier humanity. We can no longer be content with what our ancestors considered right. We must raise our children so that they can form their own judgments. Thus it is imperative that we break through the narrow confines of our preconceived ideas and take a stand in the larger life and work of the world. We must no longer look for simple concepts with which to explain the most important questions of life. For the most part, even when there is no wish to be pedantic, people try to explain most things by using superficial definitions, in pretty much the same way they did in a certain school of Greek philosophy. People asked, "What is a human being?" The answer was that a human being is a living being who stands on two legs and has no feathers. Even today, many definitions are based on the same reasoning. Someone, however, did some hard thinking about what might be behind such portentous words. The next day, he brought a plucked goose. Here was a being able to stand on two legs and lacking feathers, and the student now asserted that this was a human being. This is an extreme example of what you find in Goethe's play Getz von Berlichingen, in which a little boy begins to describe what he knows about geography. When he comes to his own area, he describes it according to his lesson book, and then goes on to describe a man whose development took place in this same neighborhood. But he lacks the foggiest idea that this man is his father. Out of sheer erudition, based on a book, he does not recognize his own father. Nevertheless, an experience I once had in Weimar goes even further. In Weimar, there are, of course, newspapers. They are produced in the usual way of small places. Bits and pieces of suitable news are cut from newspapers of larger towns and inserted into the small town newspaper. Once, on January 22nd, we read this item of news in Weimar. Quote, "Yesterday there was a violent thunderstorm over our city," unquote. But this bit of news had been taken from the Leipzig Nachrichten. Such things happen, and we are continually caught in their web of confusion. People theorize in abstract concepts. They study the theory of relativity and get the idea that it makes no difference whether a man drives a car to Osterbeek or Osterbeek comes to him. But if we wish to reach a conclusion based on reality, we would have to say that if the car is not used, it does not suffer wear and tear, and the driver does not get tired. But if the opposite happens, the effect will probably be the opposite. If we think in this way without comparing every line and movement, common sense tells us that our own being changes when it goes from a state of rest to a condition of movement. Keeping in mind the kind of thinking that prevails today, it's no wonder that a theory of relativity develops when attention is turned to things in isolation. If we return to reality, however, it becomes obvious that there is no connection between reality and theories based on mere relationships. Whether or not we are educated or smart today, we continue to live outside reality. We live in a world of ideas, much as the little boy in Getz von Berlichingen, who did not recognize his father, despite the description of him in the geography book. Our way of life lacks direct contact with reality. This is exactly what we must bring to school. We must face this direct impact of reality. We can best do this if we understand everything related to the real nature of the human being. For this reason, I have repeatedly pointed out how easy it is for people to assert today that children should be taught pictorially through object lessons, and that nothing should be presented to them that is beyond their immediate comprehension. In doing so, however, we are drawn into the most objectionable trivialities. I have already mentioned the calculator. Now consider this example. At the age of 8, I take something in, but I do not really understand it. All I know is that my teacher says so, and I love my teacher. He is my natural authority. Because he has said it, I accept it wholeheartedly. At the age of 15, I still do not understand it, but when I reach 35, I encounter an experience that recalls, as though from wonderful spiritual depths, what I did not understand when I was 8, but that I accepted solely on the authority of the teacher I loved. Because he was my authority, I felt certain that it must be true. Now life brings me another experience, and suddenly, in a flash, I understand the earlier one. All this time it was hidden within me, and now life grants me the possibility of understanding it. Such experiences lead to a tremendous sense of obligation. One has to say that it is indeed sad for those who have no experience of such moments in life, when something arises from one's inner being into consciousness, something accepted long ago on the basis of authority, but not understood until later. No one should be deprived of such experiences, because in later years it is a source of enthusiastic and purposeful activity in life. But let us add something else, I said. I said that between the change of teeth and puberty, children should not be given moral precepts. Instead, we should be careful to ensure that the good pleases them because it pleases their teacher, and the bad displeases them because it displeases their teacher. During the second period of life, everything should be based on an affinity for goodness and an aversion toward evil. Moral feelings are implanted deeply in the soul, establishing a sense of moral well-being when experiencing benevolence, and a sense of moral discomfort in experiencing malevolence. Then comes the time of puberty. Just as walking is fully developed during the first 7 years, and speech during the next seven years, so during the third seven-year period, thinking comes into its own and becomes independent. This takes place only with the beginning of puberty. Then we become truly capable of forming a judgment. At this time, if feelings have been planted in us and a good foundation has been laid, as I indicated, then we begin to form thoughts out of an inner urge, and we are able to form judgments. For example, when something pleases me, I am bound to act in accordance with it. If it displeases me, it is my duty to leave it alone. The significance of this is that duty itself grows out of pleasure and displeasure. It is not instilled in me, but arises from pleasure and displeasure. This is the awakening of true freedom in the human soul. We experience freedom because our sense of morality is the deepest single impulse of the human soul. When children have been led through natural authority to a sense of morality, so that morality lives in the world of feeling, then after puberty, the idea of duty functions from the inner human individual. This is a healthy process. This is how we lead children correctly to the point where they can experience individual freedom. People lack this experience today because they are unable to have it, because before puberty, knowledge of good and evil was instilled into them. They were indoctrinated with what they should or should not do. Moral instruction pays no attention to the right approach, and it gradually dries up human beings, makes them into skeletons of moral precepts on which one's conduct in life is hung like clothes on a hanger. Life cannot form a harmonious whole unless education follows a course that is different from the usual one. It must be understood that children go through one stage between birth and the change of teeth, another between the change of teeth and puberty, and yet another between puberty and the age of 21. Why do children do one thing or another during the period before the age of 7? Because they have a desire to imitate. They want to do everything they see done in their immediate surroundings. But what they do must be connected with life. It must lead to the activity of life. We can do much to bring this about if we accustom children to feeling gratitude for what they receive from their environment. Gratitude is the essential virtue in children between birth and the change of teeth. They should see that everyone who has some relationship to them in the world shows gratitude for what they receive from this world. If, in confronting the outer world and wanting to imitate it, children see gestures of gratitude, it helps to establish the right moral human attitude in them. Gratitude belongs to the first 7 years of life. If gratitude has been developed in children during the first period, then, between 7 and 14, it is easy to develop what must become the motivating impulse, love, in everything they do. Love is the virtue that belongs to the second period of life. And after puberty, the experiences of love between the change of teeth and puberty becomes duty, the most inner of human motivations. It becomes the guiding line for life. Goethe once expressed this beautifully when he asked, "What is duty?" "It is when we love what we demand of ourselves. This is the goal we must attain. But we cannot reach it unless we are guided to it by the stages of gratitude, love, and duty." A few days ago we saw how things arise from an earlier period of life and carry into later ones. I spoke of this when I answered a question. Now, I must explain that this also has a good side. It is something that must happen. Of course, I do not mean that gratitude should cease at 7 or love at 14, but this is the very secret of life. What we developed in one period can be carried over into later ones, but it will metamorphose, intensify, and change. We would be unable to carry over the good of one period if it were impossible to bring along the bad as well. But education must be concerned with this. It should ensure that the inherent human forces that enable us to carry over something from an earlier to a later period are used to advance goodness. To accomplish this, however, we must use what I spoke of yesterday. Consider the case of a child in whom there is a possibility of moral weakness in later life because of certain pathological tendencies. We perceive that goodness does not really please him, nor does malevolence awaken displeasure in him. In this respect, he does not progress. Then, because love cannot develop in the right way between 7 and 14, we try to use what is inherent in human nature itself. We try to develop a real sense of gratitude in the child, educating him so that he turns with true gratitude to the natural authority of his teacher. When we do this, matters will also improve in the realm of love. Knowledge of human nature prevents us from doing things in such a way that we say a boy lacks love for goodness and an aversion toward evil. Therefore, I must instill this in him. This cannot be done. But this happens on its own if we foster gratitude in a child. So it is essential to understand the role of gratitude in relation to love in moral development. We must realize that gratitude develops naturally in human nature during the first years of life, and that love is active in the human organization as a soul quality before being expressed physically at puberty. What then manifests externally is already active between 7 and 14, as the deepest principle of life and growth in human beings. It lives and weaves in our inmost being. Here it is possible to discuss such things on a fundamental level, so I may be allowed to say what is undoubtedly a fact. Once teachers have understood the nature of an education based on real knowledge of the human being, when we are engaged in the practice of such education, on the one hand, and on the other, whenever we are concerned with studying the anthroposophic worldview, each affects the other. Teachers must work in the school in such a way that they take it for granted that love is working inwardly in children and comes to outer expression in sexuality. Anthroposophic teachers also attend meetings where they study the worldview of anthroposophy. There they hear from people who have gained the necessary knowledge that comes from initiation wisdom, such as the fact that human beings consist of physical ether and astral bodies and an I being, capital I. Between the ages of 7 and 14, the ether body works mainly on the physical body. The astral body descends into the physical and ether bodies at the time of puberty. There are those who are able to penetrate more deeply into these matters. They are able to perceive more than just physical processes, and their perceptions always include spiritual processes. And when these two processes are separated, they can perceive each separately. Such individuals can discern in boys of 11 or 12 how the astral body is already sounding, chiming, so to speak, with the deeper tone that will be heard outwardly at puberty. And a similar process takes place in the astral body of girls at 11 or 12. These are facts, and if they are viewed as realities, they tend to illuminate life's problems. And we can have some very remarkable experiences in relation to these things. For example, in 1906 I presented a number of lectures in Paris to a fairly small group of people. Footnote: Esoteric Christianity, An Outline of Psychological Cosmogony, May 25th to June 14th. It's the collected works, number 94. End of footnote. I had prepared my lectures with these particular people in mind, considering the fact that this group included highly educated people, writers, artists, and others, who at this particular time were concerned with specific matters. Things have changed since then, but at that time, something very specific was behind the matters that commanded their attention. They were the kind of people who get up in the morning filled with the idea that they belong to a society that is interested in its literary and art history. And when you belong to such a society, you wear this sort of tie, and ever since some certain year, no one goes to parties in tails or a dinner jacket. One is aware of this when invited to dine where such topics are discussed. Then in the evening one goes to the theater to see plays that deal with current issues. Then the quote-unquote poets write such plays themselves. Initially there is a man of deep and inward sensibility, out of whose heart these great problems arise in an upright and honorable way. There is a Swedish poet, Strindberg. Later on there are those who popularize Strindberg to a wider public. And so, when I held these Paris lectures, the particular problem was much discussed that had recently driven the tragic Otto Weininger, 1880 to 1903, to commit suicide. The problem that Weininger portrays in such a childlike but noble way in Geschlecht und Charakter, Sex and Character, was the problem of the day. After I had dealt with the matters essential to an understanding of the subject, I went on to explain that every human being manifests one gender in the outer physical body, but carries the other gender in the ether body. So a woman has a male ether body, and a man has a female ether body. Human beings in their totality are all double-gendered. We carry the other gender within us. When something like this is said, I can actually see how people begin to look out from their astral body. They suddenly feel that a problem is solved when they have chewed on it, which they have chewed on for a long time. A certain restlessness, but a pleasant kind of restlessness, becomes perceptible among the audience. Where there are big problems, not just the insignificant sensations of life, where there is real enthusiasm, even if it is sometimes close to small talk, again, one becomes aware of how a sense of relief, of being freed from a burden, emanates from those present. So, teachers who are anthroposophists always view big problems as something that can work on them in such a way that they remain human at every stage of life. They do not dry up, but stay fresh and alert, and able to bring that freshness with them to school. It is a completely different matter whether a teacher merely studies textbooks and presents their content to the children, or whether a teacher steps out of all of that and, as a simple human being, faces the great perspectives of the world. In such cases, when such teachers enter a classroom and teach, they bring what they have absorbed into the atmosphere there. The end of Lecture 6.